This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off-limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 937. I think we're just going to jump right to the corkboard. Oh, can I promote like a silly little thing?
Of course.
I've been renovating this, renovating the house, and I've been posting with the hashtag house shit because I just want to document it. And I set up a whole, people are asking me a lot about it. And so Lydia and I had a Pinterest page where we were just like pinning stuff back and forth for just like inspirational stuff. So I'm just Hardwick on Pinterest, and you can just see it's the house shit thing there. If anyone cares, I don't know if anyone's. If you're not watching it, don't worry about it. But I just post these Instagram stories almost every day about the progress of the house renovation, because I love house renovation and I love renovation shows, and and it's a good way for me to document it. So I've been doing that, and that's my dumb little plug.
Awesome. Tanya Dapke writes, I am co-leader and board member for 500 Women Scientists. Our mission is to serve society by making science open, inclusive, and accessible. We are currently trying to raise money for a great organization called Ciencia Puerto Rico. Local pods will be presenting science salons to raise money. You can find more info by going to 500womenscientists.org, and they're going to have events. The salons are kind of like talks and women, you know, scientists get together. So they sound really cool. They'll have some in Corvallis, Oregon, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Anchorage, Knoxville, Tennessee, Atlanta, Georgia. And also you can find out more info about Ciencia Puerto Rico by going Ciencia, and that's CIENCIAPR.org. And then also John Garcia writes, I started doing my own thing inspired by many people, including Chris, a few years ago, drawing a new sketch every single day. This practice has led to many different opportunities for me, and I'm forever grateful. My art can be found at rockerjohn.com, and that's RokRJon, or on Instagram at RokRJon. _ He donates proceeds of everything he sells to various charities. So his stuff is really cool. So go check him out.
Excellent. This episode is David Oyelowo, who is an incredible actor. Maybe you saw him as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, for instance.
Very
but
good.
Great, great, great actor, and turned out to be a hell of a nice guy. I remember this conversation and thinking, like, God. Why does it have to end?
Yeah, he came ready to go.
He was great. He's promoting Gringo, which is opening March 9th. Joel Edgerton is in that. Charlize Theron. It's great. I saw it. It's comedy. It's fucked up. It's great. Oh, and Charlton Copley.
Oh, he's so great.
Who was on the podcast a few years ago for Hardcore Harry. His American accent is crazy.
Really?
It's so good.
I've never heard him talk any other way.
Yeah, it's good.
So interesting.
It's good. Yeah, he's South African, but his American accent is pretty fantastic. And David's great in it, too. So go see Gringo March 9th. This episode brought to you by Beachbody On Demand, which is an online fitness streaming service that gives you unlimited access to a huge variety of highly effective world-class workouts, personalized to meet your needs. As I've said before, I do work with a trainer, you know, Tom, of the Pro You podcast. But, you know, if I'm traveling or if, like, Tom's not available or whatever, or I just want to do, like, maintenance work, I use this app in between just to do, like, quick. There's, like, these great 10-minute workouts. There are really, you know, there are more intense workouts. They have, like, P90. They have yoga. It really is a fully comprehensive app to give you pretty much anything that you would need for a workout. It's cheaper than a gym. You don't need a ton of equipment.
You can do it on your own time.
Absolutely. There's cardio. There's weight training. There's yoga. There's low impact. There's even dance. There's over 600 workouts. You can sort by workout type or trainer. There's nutritional help on there. So give it a try if you're even marginally interested in fitness. It's a great way to just look into it to see, like, oh, I want to dip my toe in the water.
It's a good way
bit.
To get into it. Just do those 10-minute workouts. Build yourself up.
Right now, you can get a trial membership when you text ID10T to 303030. You're going to get full access to the entire platform for free, all the workouts and nutrition information for free. Just text ID10T to 303030. Also, Audible is great. Audiobooks for anything that you want, book-wise, that you want to put in your ears if you don't have time. It's very difficult for me to sit down and read a book just because of my schedule.
Yeah.
And because I'm in transit all the time,
stuck
audiobooks.
In traffic. It's perfect.
I just finished Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday, and now I'm listening to The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which is really funny. but your books are yours to keep with Audible. You can go back and re-listen anytime, even if you cancel your membership. It's through your phone, through your car, from a tablet, a computer, Amazon Echo. You can get through tons and tons and tons of books while doing almost anything. You can fill your time with your audio life with anything. Is it going to be the same playlist you listen to all the time or something entertaining? Or something that you can learn. Audible is offering the listeners to the ID10T podcast a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/ID10T and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a free title and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/ID10T or text ID10T to 500-500 to get started today. Books, magazine and newspaper publishers, business information providers, broadcasters, entertainers, they got you covered. So thanks to Audible for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast, which is episode number 937. David Oyelowo, Katie, please roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Saw you at the Black Panther premiere last night, but I just didn't want to come up and go, hey, you're gonna be at my house tomorrow?
So. Yeah, that may have freaked me out a little bit out of context.
Hey, want to hang out tomorrow? Why don't you leave me alone?
How great is that film?
It's great. I mean, it, you know, when I saw the Comic-Con footage last summer,
yeah.
The cast had just seen it for the first time during the panel, and so they were freaking out, and the audience was freaking out, and everyone freaked out. They all it escalated each other's freakouts, and so I've been excited about that movie since then, and it did not disappoint in any way.
No, I know. That's the thing that I find extraordinary is the fact that there's a lot of pressure, a lot riding, and with every one of these Marvel movies that does well, it puts pressure on the next one, you know, because I've never seen a strike rate like it, really. Especially in a artistically maligned, if you like, set of movies. You kind of, if you're a aficionado, you're sort of waiting for the bubble to burst.
Sure.
But, you know, what Ryan and the cast and everyone involved has done is not just, in my opinion, make the best Marvel movie yet, but also something that has a cultural vibrancy and a social commentary that speaks to the now in a way that is, you'd be doing well to do that in any movie.
Absolutely.
Let alone a superhero movie.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that Marvel, I think it's a formula that they really cracked in terms of getting really talented directors and allowing those directors to make a film that's really their point of view, but somehow still fit into this greater universe of a bunch of different directors with their points of view. And so you're not getting, it would have been so dangerously easy for every movie to feel cookie cutter and like now this hero and this hero.
Right.
And, you know, Thor 3 was brilliant and totally different from Guardians, which is totally different from Black Panther, which is totally different from Ant-Man. I mean, it's, and so there's a real conversation happening, a real creative conversation happening around these.
Very much so. And what Black Panther is, I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean,
my wife ended up having to find out that her shooting schedule shifted, so she had to work. We found out like 2 days before the premiere, so she wasn't able to go. And I'm like, oh man, am I really going to go this thing by myself? And I was like, you know what, I gotta go.
Right.
And I'm so glad I did. Because I was excited. Not only was I excited to see the movie, but seeing it with that audience was so explosive.
Oh my goodness!
It was just such a. It was such an incredible theatrical experience.
I've never been anything quite like that. The energy was just extraordinary. Anyway, but that was quite the night. But I'm glad you didn't introduce yourself as such, because my wife was with me and she would have asked questions and it would have been a whole thing. Why are you at this guy's house tomorrow?
it's so hard to explain. It's sort of like a recorded conversation. I don't know either. Yeah, it just, you know, I can get kind of shy at those things, because you rarely ever think past the first thing that you're going to say to someone, where you go, hey, I know you from this thing that I saw you in, or I know. And you don't really ever think, well, what's the other person supposed to say? Oh, okay, great. You know, like, I just feel bad bothering people. So I just didn't.
I hate you. Good choice.
Do you ever go up to people at these things and say anything?
At a premiere?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's got to the point now for me, wonderfully, whereby people have seen my work, and so people who I really admire, you hover in the anticipation of getting to speak to them, and then they go, oh, I saw you're this, that, and I'm always thrown by that. So, yes, I think. Of course I do, but now there's sort of this weird added element that I always get thrown when people...
I mean, you're in pretty big movies now. It's not that... And you were on a pretty big British series, too. So it's not... I really shaped that spread.
But when you're just living your own life, and I personally do not... I don't go to a bunch of those things.
Right.
And, you know, my wife and I live in Tarzana, quite far away from all the noise, with our kids, and so you do your work, but you're not sitting in every living room seeing if they're watching it or not. You're not in every movie theater. It's quite hard. And the thing is, now sometimes you'll do a film that'll do okay in theaters, but it'll have a robust life on planes.
Of course.
Or on Apple TV or on Netflix. Or, you know, someone was telling me the other day, which I wasn't aware of, but on MLK Day, four different channels literally played Selma on a basic cycle all day.
Yeah.
I mean, all day. So... You know, people who may not have seen it 3 years ago when it came out, they would have been oppressed by it on four different channels on MLK Day. So, you know, I think it's things like that that you're not necessarily aware of that heighten awareness. And it throws me. You
know? Well, it also because it, I mean, listen, just the idea of playing Martin Luther King is, of course... I imagine it was probably exciting but terrifying at the same time. Was there any part where you go, okay, I really cannot mess this really, I really need to stick the landing on this?
Well, you feel that way on virtually every movie you do, especially when it's playing a real person, let alone someone of historical significance. I have to say, one of the blessings in terms of playing Dr. King was that I'm not African-American, and so therefore I didn't quite have the cultural weight, you know, having, for instance, grown up with my grandparents having Dr. King, JFK, and Jesus on the wall in a line together. I didn't have that. I, of course, understand who he is, what he means, but, you know, the equivalent for me as a Christian would be like, okay, go play Jesus. Oh my God, I am not so sure about that. And that helped with, you know, any kind of humanizing I was able to do of him, because I don't think you can play an icon. You can play a human being who attains iconic status, but you can't approach them as this important character. That's never going to be the truth of them.
I'm curious, because this is just something I noticed having, you know, spent some time in England, but how many, has anyone in an interview said, so as an African American, you're like, I'm actually
all the time. All the time. And how do you well, you understand where it's coming from, and it's yeah, I mean, it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what that phrase actually means. But, you know, the odd thing is I've now become an American citizen.
Of course, of course.
So it's sort of, well, I get, you know, I have African heritage, you know, I'm Nigerian, and I'm now legally American. So it's not as ridiculous as it once was, but yeah, no, that happens all the time. There's a phrase, we know, I'm an African American.
Gotcha.
is what I actually am. I think that's a phrase we should introduce to the culture, but yeah, that happens all the time.
I think I heard this, must have been, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I was in London, and an American said this to a black British person, and said something about an African American. He was like, "We're black, mate." You know, it was just like, how dare you suggest we're American? What is wrong? And the American was so flustered because they were trying so hard to, like, oh no, I didn't. I was just trying to. Oh no, you know.
I've been called an African American Brit before.
which is
also very odd. But at least they're trying.
At least there is an acknowledgement.
Yeah.
There is a truth of an acknowledgement there. And your kids are 100% American. Like, they were raised in America.
Two of them. Two of my kids were born in the UK before we moved here, and then two of them were. One was born here in LA. The other was born in Pittsburgh, of all places.
Well, so what does that do? So are your kids' citizenships divided, or are they? Do they all? How does that work?
Well, when my wife and I became citizens, they.
Got it
automatically, but they effectively all have dual citizenship. So they have British passports,
fantastic,
as well as American passports. So we have our get out of jail free pass, basically. Yeah.
My wife found out that she is eligible for a dual Irish citizenship.
Uh-huh.
So I'm trying to get her on that. Like, come on, let's just. Our kids will have a key to go wherever they.
It's a good thing to have, you know. Keep your options open. But no, it's. I mean, it's very, very nice. Just from an identity point of view, just to, I mean, you know, I feel like a citizen of the world, really, because I identify as Nigerian, I identify as British, I now identify as American, especially as I'm raising kids who identify as American, and I think that's kind of a great thing.
Well, if you grow up in America, part of the reason why I think we can be viewed as a little self-centered is because our landmass is so huge, and we're so, you know, effectively cut off from so much of the world. But then, you know, you go to London or you go to other parts of Europe, and it, like, you just see so much. I mean, if you live in coastally, you see a lot of different cultural cultural engagement, but over there it's like people speak multiple language and they understand multiple cultures because you don't have to go very far to be in another country.
Exactly.
And so I was a little jealous about that, because I've known so many people as Americans that have said, like, what do I need to travel for? Like, because you don't if just travel and then you'll understand why you need to travel.
But I think it's also a byproduct of America being very good at selling the idea of America being the best.
Right.
America being the most powerful nation in the world, being the number one this. I mean, even the fact that, you know, the World Series for a sport and a sporting event that pretty much only happens in America is indicative of you know, propagating this idea sure. of the center of the world is America. And so I think that it's also that when you think, and it's such a big country, you can ski, you can go to the beach, you can climb the mountains, right. you can be in the desert. You know, it does have everything, but it doesn't have, you know, the culture that you get to experience elsewhere. And that is one of the things I really appreciated about living in such a small country like the UK and England specifically, is because you felt the need to leave and see other things, because, you know, cabin fever is something you would feel. I felt, anyway, just living in that small country. And so it's something for my wife and I with our kids, we've been quite conscious to make sure they're not growing up as those sort of inward looking Americans, but outward looking.
Well, so if America is kind of seen as the, you know, holding up the foam finger that says number one on it, yes. you know, what, how would you describe, like, what is British pride entail? Because I feel like there's a little, it can be a little complicated, because I feel like culturally, Brits are a little more like, no, I don't want to stand out.
Right.
You know, and obviously not for everybody, but there is that whenever someone tries to stand out, everyone's kind of like, shut up, you fucking cut. You know, it almost seems like, who do you think you are? You know,
they're almost yes. like, well, that's a byproduct of the class system of know your place, but also you're looking at a post-empiric Britain, you know, Great Britain is a little bit of false advertising these days, I think.
Sure.
You know, Britain is no longer a country that somehow hoodwinked the world into being so pervasively colonized by it. Mm-hmm. And effectively, Britain is kind of the 51st state in some ways now. So you know, where does Great Britain lie in the grand scheme of things? I don't know, but I do know that there's a self-deprecating, borderline self-loathing kind of attitude as it pertains to once having been great and now not commanding quite as much power, but you still have the vestiges of what that once was.
You got a palace.
You know, exactly. You know, so it's a complicated thing, as borne out by the relationship that Great Britain has with America.
I mean, I tell you, there's, you know, there's almost no greater seed for comedy than self-loathing. It's some of the best comedy comes out of self-loathing.
Yes. Well, we do that well in the UK.
What were some of your favorite British comedies growing up? What did you watch?
There was a show called Some Mothers Do Have 'Em.
Oh, I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah, that with Frank Spencer. Mm-hmm. And I used to love that. Hello, Hello, when I was growing up, was another one. But, you know, more recently, Ab Fab is a great piece of self-loathing / self-aggrandizing comedy, but yeah, I mean, you know, we do those well.
I mean, because I was finally able to get the system to play, so I got to watch Gringo, and you're great in it, and it.
Thank
and
you.
It's and, but it, but it's a it is like a caper comedy. It's
yeah.
like a real. So, do you sort of look at projects and say, like, well, I just did something that was heavy, I kind of want to do something more light now? Or do you say, I'll just green light the projects as they come my way?
It's a bit of both. I mean, sometimes something comes along that is so undeniable that you just have to do it, regardless of whether you think you may be accused of having done something similar recently, or this is the kind of thing you're known for. You know, sometimes if you're blessed enough to have that, you'll have a quick succession of things that may be deemed similar. But, you know, with Gringo in particular, I did want to do something a bit different, but also this script came along that was very much conceived in terms of the character I play as not being someone who looks like me or is like me. But there was just something in it that I responded to. And as I started having conversations with Nash Edgerton, who directed it, the idea of playing this hapless everyman as a Nigerian immigrant who firmly believes in the American dream and what goes on to happen to him as a result, just felt like a rich and fresh way into this particular story, this particular kind of caper that, you know, not dissimilar to what we were just saying about Black Panther and its cultural and socio-political resonance, is that, you know, what does being an immigrant to this country mean now? What does believing in the American dream mean now? What does capitalism mean now for someone who believes that they can come to this country and make headway, and to see that dream be so severely pummeled as is the case for Harold, you know, that just felt like something interesting to explore.
He says something really, I'm not going to spoil too much, but your character says something really interesting in there, which I think a lot of people feel, which is ultimately he expresses this idea of like, he basically gets fucked for just doing his job.
Right.
Like, he's trying, it's the guy who's trying to do the right thing in his personal life and his professional life. And every time he does the right thing, and I guess it is sort of, both in his personal life and professionally, there is sort of a capitalist thing that happens that just ends up fucking him over, you know? And it is that sort of idea of like, I thought you were supposed to like do good things and do good work and then good things happen. What is this?
Yes. Yeah. No, exactly right. I think most people, generally speaking, believe that if you're a good person and if you treat people well and if you work hard at what you do, good things should follow. But in a capitalist society, at its zenith, at its height, and the dark underbelly of the American dream is trampling on heads to get to where you want to get to.
Right.
I mean, that's the truth of the matter. There is a pure side to it, and there is a very dark side, which I would argue has been more prevalently embraced than you know, what the aspirational elements of the American dream. And so, you know, I think to look at that through the eyes of someone who is lacking in cynicism, maybe unwisely so, but still admirably so, is to kind of really, I think, is the way to look at a true everyman. And so, you know, and I'm the son of immigrants. My parents emigrated to the UK. I have emigrated here with my family. So I know what it is to come to a new place full of hope, and to have some of those hopes dashed, to have the true nature of that place reveal itself to you, and to have to navigate that.
I mean, it is interesting. So you almost have to remind people sometimes, like, hey, Homo sapiens sapien didn't start on this continent, you know? It's like most of the people who are here now, their families or they came over at some point.
Right.
And everyone, you know, I've done the ancestral family tree. I know every part of, you know, Europe that my family came over from and became hillbillies in the South,
Right.
And so it's, you know, my mother's side was Italian. The Italians came over and they had a rough time in New York in the early 1900s. And so it just seems like you don't, no one really has to go that far back to really have some type of an immigration story on their hands.
But we forget that. We forget that when we become the dominant culture anywhere. And so, and that's part of what tribalism is. You know, it's a very human thing that once you gain numbers, once you gain power, once you gain an empire and it looks predominantly like a certain demographic, that becomes the dominant culture. And anyone and everyone else who is not that dominant culture is a threat to the survival of the dominant culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, and look, we are facing that squarely in this country right now, which again is why, for me, when I read the script and it made me really laugh, as it was, I just thought, ooh, there's an extra layer we can add here that hopefully is going to resonate in a more potent way.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting that it's, and in some cases, it almost seems like the privilege aspect comes from the fact that parts of the dominant culture don't realize that they're the part of the dominant. I think there's not a malevolent in all cases ignorance, but just kind of a general ignorance.
Oh, it's willful. You know, the survival of the dominant culture is incumbent upon forgetting that it was a struggle and that there were people crushed in order to gain dominance, in order that your supremacy is unquestioned and unquestionable. So, you know, the idea that you were once the scrappy Irishman or the scrappy Italian or that whatever doesn't chime with the idea that you are head honcho.
Right.
And it also enables you to treat other people badly, because, you know, to remember what it was like doesn't serve the narrative and enable you to sleep well in your bed knowing that you are doing to others what was effectively done to your grandparents.
Sure, but it's all just fear. I mean, it's all just fear. It's all just fear-based, you know? I would imagine a lot of it's fear-based of like, oh no, what if I need to survive. I need to, and not sort of putting the right data points in place and being like, well, you can survive with that. It doesn't have to be that way. You know, right. Like you could survive. Everyone can survive. Why can't everyone have a piece of this? Why can't everyone have role models and everyone have people to look up to and dreams to, you know, I mean,
but it's also about power. And I would argue fear of mortality. I think you are able to stave off the idea of death if you feel powerful, if you feel king of the hill.
It's an illusion.
You know, it's a complete illusion. And again, you know, everything we're saying is about a string of lies that you have to tell yourself in order to get out of bed and feel like you can get through the day when it comes to, you know, a notion of the dominant culture. But these lies are things that, you know, need to be debunked, I think, in order to be our best selves.
I mean, I would ask you, because you, I know you were born in 76.
Yes.
I was born in 71. And I'm curious if did you have sort of a crisis where you felt the fear of mortality? But then I also think, well, you have four kids.
Right.
So most of your energy is probably, when you're not working, it's probably somewhere in that region.
It is sucked. That's the word you're looking for. Completely and utter parasitically sucked from my every marrow into my four seedlings. Yes, you would be right.
They are the future.
You would be right in saying that. Yes, yeah, it is. But nothing really brought my own mortality to the fore in the way, you know, my mother passed last year, and that,
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thank you. But that'll do it, you know, when someone really close to you and someone who, you know, is the buffer between you being next, as it were,
right?
That really sort of brings it to light. But it also gives you an incredible gift, which is that you face each day having debunked the lie that you're going to live forever, and the fact that you need to plow as much as you can of goodness into your children, because your day too will come, sometimes earlier than you even anticipate. So, you know, it's a very bittersweet thing to have your mortality right in front of you, but, you know, it, boy, does it make you make each day count all the more.
Well, yeah, I mean, as a member of the same club who's lost a parent, I know that, you know, there are two very significant stages of that mortality awakening. The first one is when you're an adult and then you realize, like, oh, my parents are not like super beings. They're just people who got pregnant and had a kid. They're just people, humans. Right. And because you didn't see them before you were able to recognize who they were. So you don't have a concept of that.
Yeah.
That's the first one. And then when you lose them, you're like, oh, okay, wait.
Yeah.
This is real. This is real. And I really better try to make this count.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And especially in the case when you have... when you have four kids, I imagine you must have to sort of console them while at the same time trying to figure out how to process your own grief.
Well, it's a funny thing because, yes, there's a degree of consolation, but you're also watching the fact that they are still in the headspace of immortality.
Sure.
You know, they are struggling to process the idea of the fact that they were, in fact, not even struggling. You can see that they're not fully able to engage with the idea that they will at some point not be here. You know, I have two teenage boys, and as teenage boys tend to do, they throw themselves around and they do things that clearly are death-defying, and things that I, you know, here's another thing that'll help you, you know, confront your mortality, is the amount of wheeled implements that my kids move around on, whether it's a skateboard or a hoverboard or there are so many two-wheeled things now that they are somehow find ways to move around on, and when I go near them, I've become my dad. You know, I have my hands out as if I'm walking on a tightrope. If I fall, it's almost definitely going to mean something's going to break.
Yeah.
Whereas they will fall a myriad of times. And sort of, they seem to literally bounce back onto the two-wheeled implement. And, you know, so for them, that's the gift of youth, is that they shouldn't feel that yet. I remember when I did this film, Red Tails, about the Tuskegee Airmen. And, you know, when we were doing the film, the Tuskegee Airmen, who were the first or the African-American pilots who fought in the Second World War and flew P-52 planes and had the most incredible bomber escort record in the Second World War. The death-defying things they did in these sardine cans with wings were inconceivable. And these guys were all in their 80s when we were doing the film. And you talk to them and say, how did you have the balls to get in a plane, do those maneuvers, shoot at people while being shot at? And they said, because we were kids. We honestly, by the time we crept into our late 20s, early 30s, there is nothing on earth that could make us get into one of those planes.
Oh my God.
We were teenagers. We just never thought we would get shot.
Right.
And so that's, you know, in essence what I mean. There's something incredible about that feeling, which is why you are at the height of your abilities from a sporting point of view, from a, you know, the world is your oyster point of view when you have that degree of fearlessness.
I wonder if it's the... I mean, there is definitely a line of demarcation of, like, pre-mortality and post-mortality. And the pre-mortality is what you're talking... The mortality awareness, I guess. But the pre-mortality and post-mortality. And I remember not being afraid of anything. But then at some point, do you think it's just falling down a bunch in life and experiencing a lot of pain that starts to make you go, okay, maybe we better hit the brakes a little bit? Or do you think it's just something chemical that just starts to say, like, all right, just so you know, we're going to have to start powering this shit down soon, so you better protect, you know, what's left?
I think it's an accumulation of pain that sticks.
Uh-huh.
You know, when my kids bounce back up, they don't really pay a price for having fallen over. For whatever reason, our bodies have been designed when we're younger to just, you know, partly because we fall in a more relaxed way, because we haven't suffered a bunch of hurt, so you actually fall better. But the more pain you accumulate, the more brittle you are in relation to the falling, and the more the pain accumulates and therefore feels like something to avoid. And so I think it's that, you know. I know for a fact, my wife and I, for instance, got married when we were very young. She was 20, I was 22. And I just know that we avoided a lot of pain by virtue of the fact that we got married young and we hadn't accumulated a bunch of painful relationship experiences that we then transposed onto each other and into our marriage.
I know that maneuver.
And it's a real thing. And it's not to say that there's anything wrong with waiting till you're a bit older to get married, but that is a byproduct of it, is that, you know, you're bringing a bunch of stuff that makes you hesitant as you approach relationships. And that was something that we didn't have by virtue of still being kids when we got married.
Boy, it's interesting to hear you say that, because it almost makes me think that life is sort of like a flea market or a junk shop, and you're just sort of going through just collecting stuff, and some of it's shitty, and some of it's like there's some gems in there, yeah. You know? But the further you go along, just the bigger that sack of stuff is on your back.
Right.
And you meet someone else at a certain point. You're like, here, I'm going to give you some of this shit. And you give me some of your shit.
Right.
We're going to combine some of this shit. And hopefully it's complementary.
Well, hopefully you're self-aware enough to shed some of that stuff as well. You know, because I think bitterness, anger, pain, jealousy, you know, these are things that we can harbor. And if you're not self-aware enough to go, that's cancer, you know, that's going to make me ill mentally and physically, and I need to let it go. And I think people who do life the best and get through it the best are those who are mindful. It's a bit like, you know, if you after Christmas you gained a bit of weight, you kind of think in January, you know what, I can either start a bit of a regime, or I can go, you know what, this is fine with me, let's just keep going. And there's a price to pay for that.
It is. Under, you know what, that's the other part too, is understanding consequences. Is understanding that, oh wait a minute, actions do have some sort of a Newtonian thing that happens where there is a reaction of something will occur as a response to this thing that I am doing.
Yeah.
And you just don't think of that, you know, when you're younger, because you haven't had enough consequences to know that there are consequences.
Exactly.
That's how you're supposed to learn.
Exactly right.
I would love to know, as someone who I'm not really a person of faith, but I know that you are. And so how in if this is not too personal a question, but in sort of processing the loss of a parent, in sort of processing all the things that you've been processing, and then, you know, still trying to remain stable as your career continues to rise, and that can be very weird. Success can be very strange. What is it about, you know, what is it specifically about faith for you that kind of grounds you, and how do you turn to it, and how do you express it and be comforted by it?
Well, in the case specifically of my mom passing away, you know, she was the person who introduced me to my faith as a Christian, and not in any sort of dogmatic way. She was just a wonderful example of what it is to be a loving human being who loved Jesus Christ and lived her life in a sacrificial way, which is at the heart of it. You know, the Bible can be summed up in love God, love one another. And my mom really lived that. And I admired her for it. And even though at stages in my youth, I rebelled against it, I mocked it, I laughed at it, I thought it was a bunch of nonsense. But I found it in my own way, because she was always a true north for me from that point of view. And then it, you know, Jesus became a true north for me when I established a relationship with him, and then the Bible sort of suddenly made sense to me in a way that it didn't when I was younger. I just felt, oh, I'm reading it out of duty or whatever. And then when she passed away, in a moment where, and I've had this at different parts of different times in my life where I'm going through something very difficult, where all you want to do is run for the hills, all you want to do is curse God and say, this is a load of nonsense, why has this happened to me? And again, going back to keeping the good stuff and ditching the bad stuff.
Right, right.
What I have found from in my life, from a faith point of view, it's a bit like when you're disciplined enough to keep weight training, to keep your body strong, and it's not that you need it to be strong every day, but then suddenly a boulder comes toppling down onto you, and you are shocked by the fact that you have the strength to withstand it. the strength not only to withstand it, but to lift it off of yourself and put it to the side and marvel at the fact that you got through it whole because you have spent time putting in the good stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's what it has been for me. My mum, no one prayed over the film Selma, in which I played Dr. King, more than her. And she got a brain aneurysm 2 months before we started shooting.
Oh, Jesus.
And so literally going into an event, and I really mean that in the true sense, an event in my life that she had been so alongside me in, we went into the production of that film without her there, without her voice, without her prayers, without her support, without her presence. And it was the hardest thing imaginable, for me anyway, to go through such a mountain climbing / mountain top experience, not only knowing that she wasn't there, but knowing that she was in a vegetative state. She was in a coma out of which she never really came out. I mean, she ended up effectively that way for 3 years before passing away, but it literally happened just before. And so if there was ever a moment where in my life I just thought, what is that, God? What on earth is that? It was that moment. But I felt so held through the process. I felt the presence of God in every take, in every phone call with my dad after shooting a day of going through the most extraordinary kind of experience I've ever had on a film set. And then the reality of the fact that my mom is still in this vegetative state, my dad is crumbling in the UK, my brothers don't know what to do, and I've got to go and learn my lines and get back on that set tomorrow morning. I was held through the process and a better person through the process than I could ever have imagined. And, you know, the Bible, there's a passage that talks about if you build your life on the rock, when the storms come, you will stand. If you build your life on the sand, when the storms come, you will fall. And that is the greatest indicator of that I have had. So, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say to you, I have a full sense of why that happened in the way it happened. But I do know that there is a definite version of that without my faith, without God in my life, without Christ as my rock, that would have been catastrophic and cataclysmic for me.
That's incredible. And I hope that it didn't, I hope that my question wasn't condescending in any way. It wasn't meant to be.
Quite far from it. I've never actually told anyone that publicly. I don't feel that way about it. I'm very happy to be open about my faith because it's something, you know, I think in this country particularly, when you look at what's going on politically and the tribalism around faith, you know, where in my opinion, people will put their political opinion as it aligns with faith over a relationship with God and what God actually says, as opposed to, you know, okay, there are certain policies that align up with my faith, so therefore I'm going to ignore incredible bad behavior as a result. You know, I think that faith, Christianity, true religion is can get tarnished by all of that. And so for me, I have no problem talking about something that is incredibly efficacious and real in my own life. If, you know, it's meaningful to anyone, great. If it's not, it's just part of my experience and who I am.
Well, and it's also, it's more of the idea of politics. I really do believe politics ruins a lot of things because I see politics as like, well, politics is the balance of power and sort of, you know, infrastructures that have to control things. Mm-hmm. And sort of like what you said before about like, there's going to be a certain amount of stepping on heads, yeah. You know? And so when politics kind of gets in and tarnishes spirituality, that's where it does kind of become impure and sort of muddy the water. And it's like, okay, well, you're not talking about a pure human experience or a pure, I don't know, transhuman experience or whatever you want to call it. But you're talking about what's best for your power, like what for you to be in power. And that's not the same. Those aren't the same. I mean, they, you might like this and you might like this, but that doesn't mean that those two are the same thing.
Right. I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, politics at its core could be defined as compromise. It is about what am I going to give in relation to what I'm going to get in order to stay in power, in order to attain and sustain my power. And often the policies and how it actually affects human beings is sidelined in a bid to stay in power. And that fundamentally is not what certainly my faith is, or what I deem to be the best of who we are as human beings. You know, one of the things that the current Me Too movement in Hollywood, I think, has enabled us to talk about now is morality. And that's something that certainly in my industry has, and when you are in a world that is very liberal and PC and leftist, if you like, which my industry certainly is, with a lot of good people who are very accommodating of people generally. But one of the things that can sometimes get eroded is the notion of right and wrong, mm-hmm. the notion of morality. And when it comes to sexual harassment or sexual politics generally, you cannot, in my opinion, boil that down to what is legally
right.
permissible or not.
Right.
At some point, you have to just look at, was that the right thing to do?
You have to look at it as human, the human questions,
exactly.
not the legal questions.
Exactly. And that, to me, bleeds into politics, bleeds into... And I do make a distinction between faith and religion, because religion, you know, a little bit like politics, can be about tribalism, can mm-hmm. be about a club as opposed to what it is for me, which is a relationship. Now, I go to church and I'm not going to say to you for 1 second, I don't have a tribe in terms of my non-denominational church that I go to in North Hollywood. But more important to me than what denomination I am is my personal relationship with God and how that then manifests in my life. And so I would say the same thing when it comes to politics. You know, how is morality playing into your politics? How is what is fundamentally right or wrong? Now, the difficult thing is reaching a consensus on what right. is right or wrong.
Right.
And I've had conversations with guys, especially now with the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement, where there are blurred lines around what is right and what is wrong. For me, my right and wrong very much stems partly from my faith and what examples I see in the Bible and those I admire around me, what is morally right. And the line for me is very firm, you know, in terms of how you treat a woman, how you treat people in general, but it's blurry elsewhere. And I think that's understandable, but it can sometimes be problematic.
Well, whenever, yeah, I mean, I think if more people could stop and really truly ask themselves, is this a human decision I'm making? Does this fall within a generally agreed upon morality and not just what can I get away with?
Right.
Or what feels good to me right now, or what's good for my ego. I think the older I get, the more I sort of realize ego decisions are the fucking worst decisions.
Right.
Because they're the sort of that lizard part of your brain. They're the most selfish ones.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, what's good for me right now? And sometimes, you know what, you should, I think it's important to make the distinction between making decisions that are positive for yourself and loving yourself
right.
and not making decisions that put yourself at the expense of other people's happiness.
100%. I mean, for me, love, the definition of love for me is self-sacrifice. And ego, which is self-love, is the opposite of love, of loving someone. You know, the best of me in my marriage is when I am perpetually putting my wife before myself. Mm-hmm. If she is doing the same for me, then by osmosis, we are in a very healthy relationship. The minute it becomes about, what do I get out of this? What about me? That's a vicious cycle that if we're both doing that, you know, it's a downward spiral. And so that, of course, I am not going to lie to you and say that's my everyday.
Sure.
And that's the way I approach life every day. But that is definitely the best of me when I am able to both consciously, inherently, innately able to put others before myself. That's when the ego is being sidelined and you're not making that. It's not the lizard part of your brain, which is in operation.
Yeah, well, and people should listen to you because you've been married for 21 years now.
20 years this year.
20 years. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And also, a lot of that sort of ego work is, I imagine, also incredibly valuable for your craft.
Oh, boy.
Because how do you have to go in and embody these characters and, you know, and very culturally important characters. And then, even in a movie like Gringo, which is sort of like, oh, it's fun, you know, it's sort of a fun, silly, it's still, would you say that you cannot go into these projects as like, what feels good for David, you know, like you really kind of need to surrender yourself.
Well, it's the hardest thing to do in my profession because you as an actor are your product. That's what you're selling. So there is an inherent self-obsession that is both engendered from without and within. Your agents, your publicists, the audience, the critics, everyone is talking about you in relation to your project. And the thing that you are trying to avoid if you are going to be a loving, outward-looking person is not focus on you, what you look like, what people think of you, whether you gave a good performance, whether you're on the upswing or the downswing, or and yet everything as an actor, both in terms of you being the one in front of the camera, you being the one on that big screen, you being the one that hopefully people are talking about in relation to a film and whether it was good or not, doesn't help with having an ego that is not overblown. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of conscious, intentional work, certainly in my life, to be done, not to be sucked into that. And the way I have found to do it, well, one of the blessings that doing theater gives you is that that is a form of storytelling that in its purest form is an act of service, because you have a situation whereby your safety net is the other actors on that stage. If anyone else didn't do their work, freezes on their lines, and makes you stood there in front of hundreds of people with nothing to do but wait for your cue, that's a terrible situation. But you are that for them as well. So theater, at its core, is an act of service to the director, to the play, to your fellow actors, and ultimately to the audience. And I think that if you come up in theater, that's a great way to dilute some of what film does to you when it comes to the ego. Because night after night, it is work. You can be a movie star and barely, you know, you can have a great editor who strings together a good performance. You can be someone who's really good looking and people don't care what comes out of your mouth and you're just happy to watch that person, you know, but you cannot be on a stage without the audience letting you know whether you told them the truth or not. And so for me, going back to the theater is a means of getting back to zero, but also having the muscle memory of what it is to serve the audience is something that I try to carry into my film work. Again, I don't succeed all the time, but boy, does it help.
It's so funny because I was just thinking, as you're talking about theater, I'm thinking like there's no close-ups in theater.
Right.
On you. It's like you're part of a group. And I think everything that we're sort of talking around is just the idea of, you know, to be a good citizen of humanity means contribution.
Yes.
You know, when you're in a group, and you rely on other people, as much as they can't forget your lines, you can't fuck them over.
Exactly.
And so the more you're contributing to the group, the better everything is. The more you're contributing in your work environment to not step on people's heads.
Right.
And maybe just to do things because it makes other people happy, or they're the right things to do, or, you know, it doesn't, you know, it's, people on the podcast are probably bored listening to me talk about that I've been sober forever, but one of the things that I didn't really learn until quite recently, like 14 or 15 years in, was just the idea of, like, it's not all about you, and right. it takes so much pressure off when you stop thinking, like, oh, it's about me, people are talking about me, they're just, it's like, nah. No.
They really are not.
They don't give a shit. They don't give a shit. And that's really comforting.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to think that you can contribute something to other people that you don't get anything out of, other than the fact that they're happier, their day is better because you went out of your way to not be a dick.
You know what's really difficult about that in relation to my profession is that there are moments where everyone is talking about you.
Of course.
And those moments are so intoxicating.
Of course.
And therefore, ultimately debilitating, that to have the presence of mind to put that in the right bucket at the right time is the difficult thing, which is why success very early can be incredibly dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're not equipped. You're not equipped to know, actually, when we're here on this podcast saying no one really is talking about you, and you open every newspaper because your movie opened last night to $100 million weekend.
Sure.
Actually, you old guys talking on the podcast, that's not true. I am the bees.
It's fleeting.
It's fleeting.
and you can kill yourself chasing it.
Exactly.
You can kill yourself chasing it. And it also creates a hierarchy. The business creates a hierarchy that sort of preys upon, you know, the weaknesses that our egos have. I mean, you know, sure, 100%. How many times have you been to a premiere and, you know, there's someone a little more famous than you on the carpet in front of you? You go, well, that's dumb. Why would I care? And it's like everyone, you're like, oh, hey, I'm over here. I mean, you can't help but feel a little human.
Yeah.
And there is something biological about that where you're like, oh, I want to be, you know, I have a need for significance.
Oh, last night you and I were both at the Black Panther premiere. And my wife and I arrived, and I've worked with Disney. I did a film called Queen of Cartway for them. So there was this long line to get onto the red carpet. And one of the publicists who I'd worked with on Queen of Cartway saw me and went, oh, David, oh, come on, let's expedite this. Took me right to the front of the queue, just, you know, to be able to hit the red carpet, get off, and my wife and I can go get our popcorn and sit down. And so, you know, we were feeling ourselves as we walked past everyone and went to the front of the line. And we got to the front of the line, and the guy who was there to introduce people onto the carpet went, Hasselhoff!
Oh, shit.
Man, come on, man! Come on! And having...
He was Knight Rider, though.
He was Knight Rider, and he is the Hoff.
He's the Hoff.
But I gotta tell you, man, we had gone past all these people, were right there, and just before we got to the moment where we felt like king and queen of Wakanda, hey, Hasselhoff, man, it's been a lot. Come on over.
Could you guys step it back? The Hoff's coming. Oh,
literally, okay, right. I would be happy if he said, "Could you step on back?" I just had a hand in my face.
No!
as I was sort of scraped aside for the
that
Hoff.
That went to so much fun. Of a place, I thought the lesson was going to sort of be like you're going to the front of the line and not remembering, like, no, but I'm a mere citizen of humanity. I'm here to contribute at the front of the line. I did the line. I think Daniel Kaluuya was right in front of me,
right?
And so it's like he could not. I mean, like, he's amazing, and he could not be, you know, like, more on top, right? Is he?
Right.
He can't even feel bad about, you know. It's like, of course he's going to get. Of course, yes. But there is that, you know, it's like those little lizard brains are still like, what about me?
Yeah,
you
know? I know. So exactly.
How do you sort of balance the need for significance? And I don't think it's all bad. I mean, I think it can be motivating. It can be part of the thing that drives us to do better, to do good, even be significant in your giving to other people is a form of significance as well.
Well, you know what? Life is going to do it to you anyway.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Just the moment you think you are the bee's knees, David Hasselhoff will jump the line.
He's got some bees in your knees.
He does. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, you're either going to go into a downward spiral of self-loathing, or you're going to see it for what it is and go, okay. Oh, that's funny. And that just happened. Let's keep it moving. Do you know what I mean? I think you can approach the same situation in two different ways.
I mean, it's funny hearing you say that because, you know, where we were all sitting, I was maybe four or five rows behind you.
Right.
And up top in there was, you know, every Marvel director.
I know. It was incredible.
There was you. I saw Ava DuVernay. I saw Donald Glover and Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah.
And then a tiny little David Hasselhoff walking into the orchestra stage. Like, what did he? Come on. I mean, I think, you know, in that case, it's sort of like, well, you know, he's still around. What do you want?
I know. Exactly. Exactly. And trust me, David Hasselhoff had his own David Hasselhoff moment night as well, you know, and that's the thing, you know. I just think it's a degree of self-awareness, and it honestly, I think, is you know, you talk about, you know, having been sober for a while, that's something you are having to be intentional about every single day.
Sure.
And that in and of itself is a kind of gift, and the reason I call it a gift is that there are a lot of people who go through life not being intentional about anything, and you hit a certain age and you go, hold, what have I done?
Right.
What am I doing here? I just thought it would be a certain way forever. And then life is just going to smack you in the face, as it does all of us at some point. And you haven't had those moments of reflection, moments where you count your blessings, moments where you go, you know what? I was a certain way for a long time, and I'm going to consciously not be that way because it produces this goodness, not only in my life, but in those around me.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't think I've had more moments. I mean, obviously I had that moment when I quit drinking when I was like 31, but I've had more of those moments in my 40s where I kind of go, oh, I chose to, because you do go through life and you sort of feel led through life. And this idea of intention is really interesting because I think, look, things happen that people cannot control.
Yes.
And so that's not to say that you can fix every problem in your life, but I would challenge people to say that there is a percentage of things that are the result of intentions that you have expressed that you may not even be aware were intentions or choices that you made or intentions you had expressed. And so how do we become aware of that, be comfortable with that, forgive ourselves of things that we regret doing, and learn from it and take responsibility? You know, how do we move on to take responsibility?
That's the big question. But the fact of asking the question, I think, is really the beginning, you know, and that is also, that's also to do with growing up. My kids are going to listen to this podcast and be like, Daddy, are you okay?
I think they would have turned it off by now.
You're probably right.
Yeah, I listened to it. Oh, what did I say? I was skateboarding. I don't know what it is. Why do I have to know everything? You're old. What do you want?
You're right. They would only be able to endure 15-second sound bites of this from an attention point of view.
So you're almost 42.
Yes.
Can you imagine when you were 17 what 42 sounded like when you were 17? This is fucking ancient.
I know what it sounds like because my kids let me know exactly what it sounded like. Dad, you're really old. I mean, you know. So and by the way, I'm young, in my opinion, to have, you know, grown teenage kids in terms of my
age. You get to be smug, though, because they're going to be 40, 42 someday and then go, oh.
Oh, yeah.
And honestly, what's comforting is like a lot of these questions that we ask our 40s, I feel like when people, I met people who say like, 50s are the best because that's where you really start kind of where everything's kind of firing and you really feel comfortable and you know how you, you know.
Right.
At least that's what I'm telling myself.
Yes. It depends on who you're speaking to.
Yes, you know. That's true.
I know. If you're with Tom Cruise, then you can see.
You want to go jump out of a plane?
Exactly.
No. Let's just hold on to it. No. We don't need to hold on to or jump out of a plane.
There's a dude who is wearing his 50s well.
Yeah.
You know, but you look, there are other people, you go, oof.
Yeah.
I'm not looking forward to that.
Well, you can make choices about your environment. You can make choice, like when your core group of the people surrounding you are toxic, it's going to have an effect. I mean, it's just like the baggage carrying through the flea market of life, you know? Like if you're around a lot of crazy baggage, it's going to spill onto you. And so at what point do you make the conscious decision to say, I want to manifest things and be around things that I want to achieve or that I want to see happen in my life?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I mean, you know, look, in terms of the film, in terms of what you just said there, is very much something that was top of mind for me in Gringo, is this, you know, this guy, Harold Schoenker, what does he actually want? You know, so many terrible things are happening to him and he has to sort of confront the fact that he's been living a lie.
Yep.
And so if that's the case, what's the truth? What's the truth of him? What's the truth of what he wants? What's the truth of what he's been told he should want out of life? And that, to me, is the spine of that character of, okay, you're going to have the crap beat out of you for 2 hours of this movie. At the end of it, what are you going to do with all of those bruises? And, you know, thankfully, in the film, you know, we get a satisfying answer.
Yes, but, you know, I think that it even goes a little bit deeper in the fact that I think like his character and like most people don't know what they want.
Right.
They just kind of have this amorphous idea of something. I want something.
Yes.
But not. Yes. And it is through this pain that he experiences that he becomes aware of what he wants. So,
exactly.
You know, in a sense, pain can be a gift. Pain for him was a gift. And not to trivialize it, but losing a parent, pain is a gift.
Yes.
Because it does awaken you in some ways, and it does create clarity and help you to understand who am I? What do I want? Well, how can I get those? You know, like, how is that going to make me happy? How do I, on top of that, become a good citizen of the world? So it's a, you know, for a film that is like really funny, like a dark comedy.
Right.
There's some really, you know, like to talk about it this way, like, oh yeah, that is life's struggle.
Yeah.
Is what this guy is going through.
Yeah.
Figuring out what it is that he wants.
Absolutely.
Have you figured it out?
Oh gosh, I don't know about that. I think it's what you just said. You figure some things out, or you have a notion of what you want to do, and then life throws you curveballs that show you yourself, and hopefully sometimes show you your better self, and show you your not so good self, and then you sort of recalibrate, you reboot on the basis of some of those buffetings that life throws at you. But I think if at your core, you know, as is absolutely the case with Harold, you know, the thing that he takes too long in some ways to reconcile with is that not everyone is good. And so he is constantly being confronted by bad behavior that makes him go, why did you do that? I don't know. he just can't understand why someone who he thought was one thing is another thing. And there is something beautiful about that. But then, you know, I think one of the hardest things about life is the fact that you are constantly trying to not go through life with armor on so that you stop feeling. But if you don't have some armor on, you may just get split right down the middle.
Of course, of course.
And it's the juxtaposition of those two things that is, I think, one of the toughest things to navigate through life. It's like falling in love. You know, how does my heart supple enough that I can let someone in, but aware enough that I just don't get my heart obliterated every time right. I entertain the idea of falling in love? And I think the only way of doing that is to try and gain wisdom through the painful things so that you can see things coming early.
Right.
Our dude, Harold, does not see things early. he's reacting to a lot of things quite late, and we see him start to, you know, take the reins of his own life a bit as the movie progresses.
Yeah, and it and ultimately it does sort of get to that idea, because the idea of contribution doesn't mean you shouldn't make yourself happy, you shouldn't follow things that you're passionate about, but it's like how do you do that in a way that is, you know, complimentary to the world. But it was, I mean, that Gringo was super fun. Was it come out March?
March 9th.
March 9th on Amazon.
Yeah.
And,
it's in theaters and it's being distributed by STX. So it's not just streaming on Amazon. It's in theaters all across the country.
Oh, yeah. Oh, STX. This makes a lot of sense because Sharlto Copley's in it.
Yes.
And Sharlto has probably one of the best American accents.
He is great.
His accent is so, you know, sometimes you can sort of, if someone's British or Australian, you can, it's usually a lilt on the R at the end of a word.
Right.
Like curling the R around.
Right.
But he does this accent in the film that's like, fuck, that guy's like,
yeah,
I know who that guy is.
I know.
I would never know he's South African if I didn't know that he is South African.
Yeah, he's amazing in the film.
But then you're also in a Cloverfield movie that's coming out very soon, which I'm excited about.
I am.
Is it still called God Particle, or is it just like the untitled Cloverfield?
It's not going to be called God Particle. Cloverfield, I am pretty sure will figure in the title in some way. But that was a ride. I mean, that was just an incredible thing to be a part of. And I genuinely cannot wait till the point where I'm no longer muzzled in relation to the sheer levels of excitement.
It's a lot of pressure. You can't talk about it.
No, you can't talk about it. But I can talk about the fact that it is worthy of the anticipation. It is worthy of, you know, all the chatter and you know, we just do some crazy stuff.
And then Chaos Walking is another thing that is coming out too. I mean, there's some good, that's kind of fun, the anticipation of like, oh, you know what's coming out.
Yeah.
And you know what's in it.
Oh my goodness. We had a great time doing that. Doug Liman is a favorite of mine as a director. And so, you know, that's not for another year or so, but boy, that was a lot of fun. You know, riding horses in the future is pretty cool. That was great. And then I have this film also coming out later in the year. It's currently called Only You, but it's for Blumhouse.
Uh-huh.
And it's a kind of a psychological thriller that is just badass. I mean, it's so great. Storm Reid, who's the lead in Wrinkle in Time, plays my niece in it, and it's a kind of a mind bending thriller, which I'm also incredibly excited about.
Fantastic. And so just bouncing off that idea of what you're excited about, is there anything in general, it doesn't even have to be work-related, but what are you... Because, you don't have to go very far to feel like the world is a toxic place and we're all going to fucking die at any minute.
Right.
And so I do really strongly believe that sometimes we forget that that is part of the story, but it's not the entire story.
Mm-hmm.
That there still are hopeful things and there still are things to be excited about. So what's something you're excited about right now? About anything? Is there anything in particular that you sort of keeps hope alive for you?
Yeah, there is. You know, my industry, the film industry, for a long time has paid lip service to representation as it pertains to people of color and women, marginalized groups. And I actually feel hopeful that we are now in a moment from which the pendulum will not swing all the way back, especially as it pertains to sexual harassment. I think that the what has been allowed to be pervasive and turned a blind eye to will no longer return. There are always going to be people who are going to behave badly, but I feel like the levels of tolerance have diminished so much that it's going to be a safer place for people to work. And not only that, but the images that we put out into the world are going to start reflecting the fact that we have had to question our morality as it pertains to how we treat each other. Along gender lines, along racial lines. You know, there are films coming out, there are people making those films, there are people behind the camera, there are people in front of the camera, and hopefully what will catch up is the people who are greenlighting the decisions mm-hmm. as to who and what. Who gets to be in films, what gets to be made, what narratives are told, what stories are told, and how they are told, how women are represented, how the objectification of women, the marginalization of people of color, the sidelining of people who are disabled. You know, all of these things that Hollywood, the entertainment industry generally, is so influential from a cultural point of view. And the more we are cleaning house internally in terms of business practices, the more it will manifest in what we put out into the world. And that is now something, if you'd asked me a year ago, you know, because I've worked with a lot of female directors and I always get asked, do I think that things have changed? And a year ago, I would say, no, I think we're in a blip. I think we're in an upswing, maybe. I think we're in a moment where people are aware of it. But what we have seen historically is that we get talked out and then things remain the same. And I actually kind of feel optimistic right now that my children, based on the moment we're in now, will be living in a slightly different world than I have been living in up until now.
Excellent. That is an amazing way to end this. This has been such a great conversation. I can't thank you enough for coming to my house. please come over anytime. Bring the kids. There's a pool.
You may regret that.
Throw them in the pool. We'll play video games.
No, this was fun. Thank you.
Excellent.
So
thank you so much, David. Good to see you. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.